Welcome to Starfleet Universe On-Call. I am Paul France, owner of France Games. I'm an SFB Online, Fed Come Online, and Starfleet Warlord. Just a reminder how to join us for the talk guest every Thursday night, starting at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can either call on the phone, just dial 605-562-0444. Just follow the directions. The call ID is 17702. Or you can participate on the web. Let's go to the TalkShoe website at www.talkshoe.com. Search for call ID 17702 or SFU on call or Starfleet Universe on call. Or for the best online experience, go to twitch.tv. Yes, twitch.tv. So go to twitch.tv/SFU on call. And you will find us right there and be able to join the wonderful chat room and join in on the conversation. And if you need to contact me for any reason, my email address is sfuoncall@gmail.com. It's sfuoncall@gmail.com. And if you want to follow me on Twitter or X or whatever they're calling it this week, you can follow me on sfuoncall. Or you can also follow me, my personal account called Paul Franz, or also you can follow me on Franz Games, which is, of course, related to SFB Online, FedCom Online, and Starfleet Warlord. Now, if this lovely podcast gets turned into a podcast available on iTunes and various other feeds around the net. Some quick news from A to B this week. It's relatively quiet because they've all been getting over COVID. Oh, fun. The virus that keeps on giving. Some quick, found on the online store this week is the F&E Civil War's double-sided counter sheet. Only $8, but it's 280 counters. Yes, you can add to your wonderful collection of counters. This is a double-sided sheet from Civil Wars, including the Pink Romulans, the rebellious Brown Zintis, the Wind Ships, the ones that are able to leave the cluster, the loyal Lyrans from the early years, and also the rebellious Purple Lyrans. You can use them for Civil Wars or simply extra counters to mark special fleets or other sectors. Moving on forward to the SFB Online tournament, the Sapphire Star 14 tournament. That one is up to the finals. That is going to be Jack Taylor in the GBS versus Jeff Clark. And the ISC, they're going to be playing on Friday, August 11th. And that's going to be at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. So if you want to watch such a wonderful game, please join them at 5 o'clock Eastern Time. If you can't make it 5, make it a little bit later, and that's fine. But they'll be starting at 5, so you don't want to miss anything. You might want to log in at 5. And moving onward and forward to the library, nothing when it comes to the clients, not much happening there this week. Been busy with other things. And also when it comes to the library report, when it comes to the SFB library, I actually got around to updating the Klingon ships the redo of the Klingon ships that Frank did. And also on top of that, I did fix, there was a Fed ship that I fixed and I can't remember off the top of my head. Frank gave it to me to fix the campaign because I think it was a scout that was missing a special sensor. And so with that, that is the news for this week. And it's me, it's the one and only Paul Franz, welcoming you to Starfleet Universe On Call. And tonight, we have Gary. Say hi, Gary.
Hi, Gary.
And we have Doug. Say hi, Doug.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good, doing good.
How's everybody doing tonight?
Pretty good. Been a long day. Just because I've been driving back and forth between here and Baltimore to go see the Orioles win, which was good. It's kind of crazy and slightly insane just because of, rough game. I'm not going to go through the whole thing here because this is not supposed to be about baseball, even though sometimes I wish it was. At the same time, I don't think I actually could do a baseball podcast, to be honest. I don't think I have enough knowledge about baseball and follow it closely enough to actually, talk about it in a clear, concise, and more importantly, thoughtful manner. So, that, we'll move on forward. And Gary, you wanted to bring back the topic about the Tholians basically ending up in the Omega Octant? Or is it, or are you thinking about something
Okay,
someplace else?
so, well, all right. So, right now on the BBS, there's two topics that I've set up. Anyone's welcome to pop in if they want. One of them is the one that we spoke about before about the Tholians in Omega. The second one is about Tholians in the Magellanic Cloud. And in that topic, Steve Petrick kindly pointed out that there's a few things that need to be kind of like figured out ahead of time before the question of them going anywhere other than the galactic barrier is set. So basically, now when the Tholians are coming to our galaxy, they have the wrong impression about how strong the barrier is. But nonetheless, they have an impression. So if something happens to give them the impression that the barrier is either stronger than they think it is, or that the something happens to their engines maybe on the sphere and it can't cross, then they have to do something else. And now I'm not too sure how clear it is in terms of how much spare resources they have, because there is talk in the notes about a lot of the systems are being cannibalized just to get to the Milky Way. But in theory, if the engines are still in good condition, the Tholians might basically park the sphere just long enough to restock and then try some other galaxy instead, like Triangulum or something like that. But that would basically steer them away from the Milky Way entirely. So the issue would be what would happen to both prevent them from coming into the galaxy, or and then also make them have to stick around in the vicinity of the galaxy. So I posted something more recently to try to kind of pick that apart. So if you look at the various like stuff that's going on, either like the quote unquote real astrogeography, or if you look at the stuff that's made up for the start of the universe, you've got various like intergalactic space is not entirely empty. So you've got like rogue planetoids, or your random black holes or other kind of things or whatever. But then you've also got you might have some displaced life forms, like for example the Banshees from Module K. A captain's log, there was an issue of captain's log that introduced a more dangerous variant of them that actually operates outside of the galaxy. And, I guess they're more dangerous because they got less to feed on, so any feeding opportunities they have to take the most of. And then also you've got the issue of other extragalactic wandering things like a death probe or a juggernaut or something like that you might run into, and that might ruin your day. So it's likely that instead of drawing a single line from the home galaxy to the Milky Way and saying that straight line is what they took, it's probably more likely that there's it kind of zigged and zagged a little bit, like at various stages, and there's probably like points where they had to slow down. Like say for example, they started running out of a certain material, so maybe they pull up to the nearest planetoid that they'd find in open space and melt it down for the mineral the resources that they need to keep the sphere going for another how many years or decades or whatever. Because actually there's something similar that there is in a story about the Sultorians in Captain's Log 41, because the Sultorian sage who's in command of this hive ship, he's literally talking about all these like dwarf galaxies or objects, whatever, that are like decades away from where the hive ship is. And he's like calculating, all right, well, if we go here and then we do that, then we do this, then we do that, and so forth. Because in that story, the hive ship that he's in controlling is being attacked by juggernauts. And so he's calculating, all right, well, if we head towards this dwarf galaxy now, then we'll run into juggernaut ABC or whatever at this point, and then maybe the next one after that. And then before the next one after that shows up, we can get to this dwarf galaxy and try to sort of grab the resources and stuff. So
right.
I guess there's very long-term thinking employed.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically the way I would see it is, now again, this is just my own thing, so
mm-hmm.
we have to see what ADB thinks about it, if ever,
right.
is the ziggy-zag route that the sphere historically took is the one, it's not necessarily the most optimal route, but it's the baseline.
Right.
And that's the one that got them to where they are now. But so you could basically have three different degrees of separation. One degree is that the sum total of adjustments is not that big, but it still means that they arrive somewhere in the galaxy. So they either arrive in Omega, or maybe in Sargasso, so maybe they'll end up, hopefully, if they go into Sargasso, they end up in a clear pocket, because
right.
if they don't, then life's going to be...
Then they're dead.
yeah. So, I mean, they really don't want to end up in the Zorkalian area, because then they'll get squished. But, so that's, I guess, degree one. And then degree two would be that maybe something happens to them, like they get into a big fight and the engines get damaged, or maybe there's a natural phenomenon that screws things up, or maybe the engines just break down because, I mean, they're spoken because, like in the galaxy, one reason why Tholian ships can't have legendary engineers is because anyone who qualifies as a legendary engineer gets redirected to the sphere, like maintaining it or repairing it. Mm-hmm. So they're not quite in that bad of straits while they're still intergalactic space, but it's possible that if even one Tholian, you know, slips and falls or something, or has a bad hair, a bad crystal day, then maybe some sort of like breakdown is worse than expected, or whatever. So that would basically mean that they might decide that they're going to have to park the ship. They're going to have to park the sphere somewhere,
right.
but they don't want to risk going through the barrier. So that means if they go to the Draco and they find the Draco colony about 100 years early, or do they divert to the Magellanic Cloud so that they can have more resources but run the risk of having more trouble, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third degree of separation would be something happens maybe 100 years earlier where it diverts them away from the Milky Way entirely. And in that case, they basically go directly to some other galaxy like Triangulum, or well, hopefully not Andromeda. But yeah, so
right.
That basically means that if the player is if the people, the game designers or the speculators are thinking of, well, how are we going to break this down into something that SFB or Fedcom players can actually do something with? Then I was thinking that maybe those degrees of separation might be a way to systematize it, so to speak, so that it all more or less fits together. So does that make sense? Or
mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, basically you're placing out multiple scenarios that could have possibly happened, including going meeting up with the falling into Draco, but you know in theory, Tholians could completely have missed our galaxy altogether. You know, there's so many different scenarios that could have taken place. You know, like, because also, if you think about it, that any delays on when the Tholians actually arrived would mean, I mean, if you discount the whole issue of, you know, the year, you know, when it comes to their effect on the Alpha Octant as it stood, because that's one thing. Well, I don't think we either of us really discussed with the whole idea of the Tholians entering, you know, landing in the Omega Octant, which is of course what effect that has on the Alpha Octant if the Tholians aren't there to be between, you know, the Romulans and the Klingons, you know, without causing. And basically, because my understanding is the Romans really did not attack the Tholians that much. They really didn't care that much about the Tholians, and they didn't really press things too hard. Obviously, they use them as for testing, as a testing ground, but really didn't push to try to take over that territory. Well, the Klingons just want them gone, you know, because that's just one less front that they'd actually have to fight.
Right.
So,
Historically, the Klingon.
No, go.
Okay, so in the historical timeline, the Klingons were actually using that territory as a launching pad to conquer the Romulan Empire. And had the Tholians not shown up, they probably would have succeeded. So there's actually a Federation and Empire scenario where the Romulan Empire is replaced by a thing called the Imperial Klingon Marches, which is still, it's like, if you think about like the, in the days before the Industrial Revolution, like if you look at the, say, the Spanish colonies in Mexico and Peru and stuff, like you would have the Viceroyalty of New Spain. So the Viceroy would be there on behalf of the king in Madrid. But in reality, he's basically running the show himself because there's such a time lag and difference in distance between Mexico or city and Madrid. That's, so the similar sort of thing where basically the Imperial, the IKM is kind of like a quasi-allied realm of the empire, of the Klingon Empire,
mm-hmm.
Based on Romulus. But they're still building Klingon ships because they take over the Romulan fleet yards. And because at the time, the Romulans had like, you know, primitive sublight ships or whatever. So
right.
The Klingons basically eventually retooled the shipyards to build like, you know, Klingon ships. But that also means that you never see the Mala cannon or cloaking device because mm-hmm. They never get developed. But I mean, so it could be interesting to kind of like, you know, tweak it a bit because, you know, module R4J has an alternate scenario where the Romulans develop warp early. So
right.
They're at no threat from being conquered by the Klingons, even if the Tholians don't show up. Or you could even mix in the Paravians from module C6 and say that if the Klingons take over the Romulans, then maybe the Gorns hold back from defeating the Paravians because they have to watch the Klingons now. And that means that the Paravians get a stay of execution. And if they trigger the ISC to an early activation, maybe you have like a version of the map from module C6, but you basically have the ISC on one side, the Paravians to the north, the Gorns, but instead of having the Romulans, you've got the IKM. And so maybe it's the Klingons who are the ones who are allied to the Paravians instead of the Romulans.
Mm-hmm.
Although in that case, the Klingons would want to make sure that mm-hmm. any of their lizard species that are subject in the Klingon Empire are never sent to Romulus because if the Paravians see them, they'll try to kill them.
Interesting. So basically you're saying that the Tholians actually saved the Klingon, the Romulan Empire. Which is one of the possible.
They sure did, yeah. Although the Romulans are very grateful for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, what was it? 2 weeks ago, I think it was? That basically we went through the alternate, you know, module R4J, where we went through the alternate histories. To me, I still think one of the most interesting alternate histories is the big switcheroo between the Vulcans and the Romulans. I mean, the passive Vulcans are the ones who left. While the more warlike Vulcans, they stayed and they extended their society and they actually control, but that's not the word that really describes them well, which is influenced. Yeah, that's
influenced.
Influenced the Federation at the early beginning, and instead of becoming, you know, the Federation, United Federation of Planets, it was what they call
Federal it? Imperial.
Yeah, thank you. So to me, I think that's one of the more interesting alternate universes for the Romulans, because just because of, you know, we In my mind, we didn't really see that explicitly ever mentioned. Maybe it's mentioned in other material that I've not read, which is possible, that the Vulcans had an influence on the starting of the United Federation of Planets. No. Even
well, in the regular timeline, the Vulcans had, I guess you could call it an early form of the Prime Directive. So they knew about Andorians and humans, whatever, but they avoided missions first contact until those species developed warp drive.
Understood. And the thing is, and here, and of course, then there's the whole issue of, I was just thinking about this, which is, okay, if the Tholians actually, let's say they still arrived at the Milky Way, but they were delayed by whatever circumstances. They're coming actually in possibly in the middle, if they landed in the Alpha Octane, which might not be the case, because of course, you got to remember that the Milky Way is turning. Also, now I'll have to agree that let's say it was 100 years. 100 years is not a really big time when it comes to the actual rotation of the Milky Way. So that wouldn't really affect the landing spot, basically, for the Tholians. And if the Tholians arrived instead of, I think, what was it, 167 or earlier than that? Do you remember, Gary?
Well, historically, they arrived in Y-79.
179, okay. If they would have arrived in Y-179, it would have been definitely a totally different animal altogether, because of the Tholians themselves wouldn't, in my mind, wouldn't have seemed, it wouldn't be as superior as they were when they first arrived. It's only because they arrived at the time they did that their phasers and their weapons were actually more advanced than the weapons that were used by the Klingons. Yes, they didn't have like heavy weapons, but that didn't matter. They had better phasers, and that's all they really needed to at least to help them at the beginning. But you know, if in Y-179, the Klingons were in full war mode, you know, because that's the middle of the general war. So if the Tholians would land, you know, quote unquote landed then the question would be, is that would they even survived?
Probably not.
Yeah. I'm thinking that
they're
thinking,
just so outgunned. If you have them as they were when they are first show up in the SFU, then no, they're not going to survive in the general war because they're going to be totally outgunned and outclassed at every level, pretty much. So it's just a random thought. Instead of like trying to finagle all that, if you want to have them in the Omega Quadrant, why not just say there was a second group of refugees? I mean, the place they come from, although maybe not as large as the Milky Way, I forget the history on that exactly, but it's still huge, and a galaxy-wide revolution. When you look at the scale of all that, it's entirely possible that, you know, there may have been more than one group of Tholians that headed out to different places, and maybe several groups went towards the same one. And like it was mentioned in the other part, there's a lot of stuff potentially in between the two galaxies. And if you really think about it, on the scale of intergalactic travel, even at the speeds that you're talking about that allow it to happen, it's not a straight line. It's more like a you know, a huge curveball kind of, because you're trying to catch the other thing that's moving. And even though you have a pretty good idea where it's going, it's still so far away that you have to keep getting closer until you can get your measurements down. So it's not going to be a perfect shot, like, you know, if we tried for the moon, because even if we try for the moon, we still have to make adjustments a little bit here and there as you
right.
go for
Agreed.
Different reasons. But if you see what I'm saying, you could have a different group altogether just land in the Omega Quadrant for, you know, whatever purpose that you want. You know, they didn't have contact with the other group, or they were part of a, you know, they had more than one group that went and they lost contact along the way and they didn't know where they were going and they didn't have time to screw around and scout and just went straight on in. Boom, there you go. Because they were desperate and they wanted a place to be and not be out in the middle of, you know, intergalactic space.
Right.
Where there's like next to nothing, comparatively speaking.
Right. Or the whole idea of... Or the whole idea of also of having a small expeditionary force that split off from the main force. And the idea was that it was going to penetrate the barrier and then come back and say, okay, this is what we found kind of thing. And, you know, they didn't realize that after they penetrated the galactic barrier, that there's no coming back out, you know.
Yeah, they're stuck.
Yeah, mm-hmm. you're stuck, in which case you can't...
There's that.
Your communications are cut off.
But if you also want to have a large presence of them, it could be a different refugee group altogether.
Right, agreed.
I mean, it could be anything. I mean, you could go with the hand-wavium aspect of that.
Agreed.
But you know, I think given the scale of what happened in their home galaxy before they came, you know, their records that you get in the canon of the SFU are from the perspective of those guys that got there. And they may not know about another group that like said, hey, we're going to get out of here too, from another part of their home galaxy. And that group might have a completely different setup. They might have all their stuff. It might just be in smaller numbers to balance it out. You never know. I mean, it's just, it could be a playtest issue or a matter of simple taste of the scenario designer. So.
Mm-hmm. Understood. And I would think... Yes, Gary?
So I'm sure if I wanted to go first. But yeah, so there are, like in both Module C5 and in the Omega Master Rulebook, there are kind of little side notes and stuff where they leave the door ajar to Thorians or Seltorians showing up or whatever. In terms of whether it's likely to happen, again, I'm not speaking for ADV, but I'm under the impression that Seltorians are more likely to show up somewhere, if only because there's, you know, they're the ones in charge back in the home galaxy now, and they have the spare resources to be able to send tribunal expeditions either to galaxies that they know the Thorians have fled to or that they think they might have fled to and they wanted to just be sure. Because so it's, and also a hive ship or even an S ship is basically a self-contained campaign generator. So it'd be a lot easier to basically park a hive ship or nest ship in somewhere new in the universe and then see how long the Sotorians last. But for the Tholians, I get the impression that they might not necessarily want to make them have too many exile groups show up after the revolt. Like, I think they want to kind of highlight the fact that Tholians in the universe are an endangered species. So they probably, I mean, like, it took a long time for them to introduce the Thorians of Draco. And even then, I guess, there's, like, very specific circumstances that kind of involve that. So I suspect, although I don't have any confirmation of this, but I suspect that in terms of in the historical timeline, having new groups from the home galaxy show up, it's probably maybe an 80-20 or 60-40 more likely that it would be the Sultorians rather than the Tholians. Which is not necessarily a bad thing. That's one reason why, I guess, because the other thing as well is that even though we don't have like an early years module for Federation of Empire, so we don't have the formal, you know, order of battle and, you know, production schedule and so forth for the really early Holdfast, we still know quite a bit about it. We still know enough to make it a very useful baseline. So if you have the same faction with the same steps that they had to take in terms of, you know, recovering their old technology or designing new things, like being able to weld their hulls together to build cruisers and stuff, that is basically a template that can be applied to what-if scenarios, placing the sphere in some other place. So it does. I wouldn't want to be the one to say that, you know, this means that there can't actually be other historical groups elsewhere. But I guess the point I was going for is that looking at it this way is maybe a good way of figuring out how it would actually function in campaign terms or in game terms, so that if there ever was a historical thing added to the universe at some point, then the tools would be in place to make it easier to do. If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And actually, I had a question for you, Gary, which is, to your knowledge, were there any other Dyson spheres except for the one? I mean, when it comes to being brought along with the Exiles, you know, they're running away from the Sultorians, other than the one for their home. How to say home Dyson sphere? Let's put it that way at the moment.
The only other one that was known so far, at least, that was known, because the problem is this: in the home galaxy, the spheres are only given their engines long enough to place them where they're going to be placed, and then their engines are removed or disabled or whatever. So a lot of these spheres back in the home galaxy were actually immobile. It's only the very new construction spheres that would still have their engines, or that would be given the engines in the first place. So when the revolt happened, a lot of the spheres that the Sultorians destroyed were sitting ducks, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So far as we know, the only other sphere that escaped the initial revolt was one that's actually in the Draco article. Because the ships, like the Sojourner, that were eventually became the Tholians of Draco, they were basically trying to protect a different sphere that was fleeing towards a different set of galaxies. But that sphere was actually caught and destroyed by the Sultorians. So when the Sultorians destroyed the sphere and went back home again, they assumed that they didn't do a thorough job of chasing down the survivors. So they assumed that they were done with in any case. So, but what the future Dracos did is basically pick up as many survivors as they could and then head towards the Milky Way. So, and then they would eventually become the Tholians of Draco. So far we know of two spheres that escaped the initial crisis, but only one of them is still around in the present day.
Okay. Yeah, I'm assuming we don't know. We have no idea of how many groups of Exiles there were, at least in the current SFU universe. History.
Well, I guess they probably don't want to be too, about that.
Yeah, I'm more curious than anything else because
they don't want to put it down too preemptively. Yeah.
What was that? I'm sorry.
But actually, another kind of half of this topic that I wanted to bring up, because we've talked before about where they might have gone, at least in Omega, because with the Magellanic Cloud, that might be an interesting topic as well.
Right.
But another side of it would be what kind of weapons or technology they would use when they get there, and what kind of enemies they'd be expected to fight. So, ironically enough, I think it's actually easier to figure that out for the Magellanic Cloud than it is for Omega, because do you have the web browser open right now?
Yep.
Okay, so could you go to the ADB homepage?
I'm going. I'm there.
All right, so if you click on the tab for Starfleet Battles.
Okay.
And then scroll down to where it says SFB in the Magellanic Cloud.
Got it.
And on that page, you should see there's a link to a PDF with a map of the LMC.
Okay. Which one? You mean the view of a map as an island galaxy or
That's the one, yeah.
Oh, that's the one? Okay. So the small one, not one. Okay. This. Okay.
All right. So you can see how, like, on the left-hand side of the map, there's the Batavai Imperium. And on the right, there's the Anim. And then you've got a bunch of the fringe space surrounding the two of them. So now, historically, the Andromedans basically showed up in the northwest part of the map. So during the first wave of conquest, they did a pincer movement to attack the Batavai and Anim at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons why they were able to do that is because, you see, there's an area that's marked NW.
Uh-huh. Neutral worlds.
So that is the neutral worlds. Because what happened is, in the timeline, the Batavai and Anim first encountered each other to the south of the core region. So the southern area that you see there, that was the more built-up region. But to the north, they were slower to get up there. So when they did, they were scrabbling for territory. But in the middle of the scrabble, the Magadim from the core basically started bursting out for the first time. And once the Batavai and Anim realized that there was a potentially common enemy, they signed an accord which created the neutral world. So they're basically their two provinces, and the economic, the resources from those, the neutral zone, is divided evenly between the Batavai and the Anim.
Hmm.
But by doing that, they turned the neutral worlds into a flashpoint, because the Magadim would launch two full-scale wars to try to burst out of the core to take it over. And also, the Anim and Batavai would wage war over who gets to control it once and for all. Of course, the Andromedans had something to say about all that. So by the time the Andromedan invasion started, there had been two major wars, the first between the Batavai and Anim, and the second between both of them and the Magadim. So they were all economically exhausted. But that basically meant that the Andromedans basically were able to start with the upper hand in terms of attacking both sides. So, but the handy thing is that area, it's relatively late that area becomes fortified or heavily occupied. So by the time the Tholians would show up, that area would be actually probably the most optimal place for the Holdfast to set up. So if you basically say that the Sphere's engines give up at the point where they get there, then the Tholians by default have to take that space over. But from a game design perspective, it's probably the most optimal place to put them.
Okay, question. Okay, so are you saying that where the neutral worlds are, that basically that part would actually be taken over by the Tholians? Am I hearing that right?
Well, I would propose that. I would say that that is a contingency that's worth exploring. Because in theory, you could have the Thorian show up anywhere in the Magellanic Cloud, but the other options are not good options. But the neutral world is the best one in terms of giving them enough breathing space to get started, but also giving them access to local technology that they can steal and use to replace the particle cannon.
Right. Right.
And speaking of the technology, there's two main weapons I want to talk about. And the first one is from the Inim. It's a weapon called the Neutron Beam.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Neutron Beam, it takes 5 points of power to fire, and it has a cooling down cycle after you fire it. So it's single turn arming, but then you've got the cooldown. And when you're firing it, you have an option of firing it at a narrow aperture, like a phaser, like a disruptor, basically, or wide aperture, like a phaser. So what the Inim often do is, when they have the neutron beam on their ships, because of how expensive it is to fire it, they set their firing arcs in LF plus L and RF plus R, and they fire only half of them in a turn, and then they fire the other half on the second turn, and vice versa. So they're alternating back and forth. So their ships are designed to be, you know, more obliquey, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about it, the Tholians already do that, because if you look at a Tholian cruiser, it's got two heavy weapon points, but they're both LF plus L and RF plus R. So if you create a Tholian cruiser that has two neutron beams instead of two disruptors, then the game already, like the Inim already basically offered the template in terms of how you're going to fly that ship in battle. Do you have any of the... Do you have module C5 on your PDF on your computer?
That's what I'm actually looking for. And just wondering if I have it. I don't see it at the moment. Give me a sec.
You're taking.
Oh, I did not mean to do that.
But you can actually see on Shapeways, if you look at the miniature for the Inim heavy cruiser, it actually has the neutron beam mounts facing 60 degrees left and right, to represent the fact that they're LF plus L and RF plus R on the SST.
Okay. No, I don't. The moment, I don't think I actually have that one. No. Ah, there it is. Actually, no, I got the SST. No. I'm not sure that would do it. I've got the SSD book, but I don't have the rule for modules.
Well, the SSD book will do. You can bring that up and go to the whichever page has the Inim heavy cruiser.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Inim heavy cruiser. That would be Inim heavy cruiser. That's page 737. There it is. Okay. Right there. There it is. Okay. And you're talking about the neutron beam?
Yeah, you're going to see two firing charts on the SSD. One of them is for the narrow mode, and one is for the wide mode.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Now, bear in mind that the range brackets, because the Inim don't use phasers, they use warp tuned lasers. So the firing brackets for the neutron beam, they're designed to match those of the lasers. So if the Tholians were using it, they'd have to get used to trying to figure out which of the range brackets matches best with phaser ones.
Right. Okay. Is there any special army requirement, like when it comes to what kind of power it can use?
Beyond from any source of power.
Okay. Just want to double check on that. Yeah, definitely change things a bit, because obviously the one minor issue, and then I do think this is a minor issue, which is that these weapons are designed with the LMC in the context of LMC, i.e. the close range, I guess you can call it. In Alpha Octant, it's all the way out to range 8, while for the LMC, it looks like it tops the quote top range is like range 6 in that context. While the Phaser ones, you know, they're good out to range 5, which is kind of different from the actual, you know, for the rest of the weapons, but for the weapons in the LMC, for example, when it comes to the neutron beam, the narrow, it goes all the way out to range 6. You know, 1 to 4. If you want to go out to range 12, it can be, you know, still 1 to 4. But after it gets outside of range 6, damage goes from 12 down to 6. And I don't think that actually costs any more energy at all. And given that, you know, there's gonna be incongruity between the two weapons, you know, the phaser ones and neutron beam, if you have them on the same ships.
True, yeah. But of the weapons that would be available to the Tholians in this scenario, I think it would be the least worst option. Because some of the other empires are either have restricted technology, or they're on the other side of the cold radiation shell, or they're not direct fire heavy weapons. So, I wouldn't give the Tholians the plasma weapons that the Inneen have, for example. So, when you think about it, I mean, it's just a lucky coincidence that the Tholians and Alpha took to disruptors and photons so well. Mm-hmm. I guess beforehand, there was no, again, those ships, I mean, you and I know that when ADB created those SSDs, they designed them with disruptors in mind. But from an in-universe perspective, those ships were designed with particle cannons in mind, or phasers only in the case of the patrol corvette. So it's just a lucky fluke that disruptors worked as well as they did. So in this case, it's just, it's, you know, one of those things to show that the Tholians in this pocket galaxy would have to try to make do or find a new normal, so to speak.
Agreed. And as you pointed out, yeah, definitely the plasma torpedo would not be good for the Tholians. And not just for, like, you know, not that, oh, it's too powerful of a weapon. It just doesn't, it would not work well with the web at all. You know, they need it so that it's a direct fire weapon versus a seeking weapon. If for nothing else, just for timing, because of what was that?
Well, the other thing as well is that the plasma E is actually a very weak plasma. The only reason why it works for the Inneen at all is because warp-tuned lasers have a 3-to-1 damage ratio against plasma. So if they're firing that thing as a deterrent, then like a Magellanic Empire, opposing Empire, would be put off by the plasma a bit more likely than anyone using an Alpha-type phaser, or an Andromeda for that matter would be. And even then, the Andromedas are only using phaser 2, so they're less good at shooting down plasmas compared to the Tholians would be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed. And well, I'm thinking about is the whole issue of play when it comes to the web, because one of the things that the Tholians rely on in my mind anyway, is that when it comes to the webs, if you poke your head through the web, what happens? The Tholians can attack you. If they're on the other side of the web, they can immediately fire whatever direct fire weapons they have at you versus, plasma torpedoes. If the Tholians use plasma torpedoes, yeah, then it's a delayed reaction. You gotta hope that they stay in place, you know. And obviously also gives them more control over, you know, what shield it gets hit at that moment in time.
Now that's the neutron beam. So, but if you go to have a look for the page where it shows the Batavai strike cruiser.
Okay. Which cruiser?
Batavai strike cruiser.
Okay, the strike cruiser. Okay. Okay. This ball. Sorry. My one cat's being quite lovey-dovey. Yes, the co-host. Okay, yeah, I got it up. So they have the all CPA.
Right.
So
you might notice that.
Yeah.
Okay. That's correct. Now, it has two CPA-2s and one CPA-3.
Okay.
You should see them on the nacelle caps.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so in terms of the option mounts, like if you're putting these onto a pirate ship or whatever, the CPA-2, it creates two boxes on the ship. But
right,
it only fills one option mount box, if that
mm-hmm.
makes sense.
Yeah.
But if you look at the CPA-3, it creates three boxes,
right,
but it takes up two boxes.
Right.
So
no, it takes up three boxes.
No matter how many boxes.
No, yeah, it takes up, it's three and it takes up three.
No. The CPA-3, it creates three boxes.
Right.
But if you're installing it onto a ship, it takes up two central line adjacent options.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So, basically, now what also happens is you need warp power to arm the CPA.
Right.
It's 3 points of warp power per turn. And depending on how many chambers you have, that's what the boxes represent.
Oh, okay.
On the SSD.
So basically, for each turn, you're charging a different chamber?
You can arm it. Yeah. So if you have a CPA-2, you can't arm it to level 3 because it doesn't have a third chamber.
Right. Holy cow.
And you can't hold this weapon either. You have to use rolling delay. So you're, no matter what, you're paying those 3 points of warp power every turn.
Understood.
Okay. So the trick is, because like for the Batavai, they actually, in the middle years, they developed the CPA-3 first. So their heavy cruiser has two CPA-3s. But closer, like a few decades later, they actually developed the CPA-2 because they got to the point where the CPA-3, they kept it for bombardment variants. Like, I guess, like direct fire bombardment, I should say, because they have mass drivers for other kind of bombardments. But they decided to try and switch more to the CPA-2 because they found it to be more useful for actual, like, battles. But the trick is that their war-class ships, they actually don't come with enough warp reactors to maintain the proper battle speed until a later refit is applied. So... but if you look at the SSD, that ship there, basically every turn, regardless of whether you're going to fire the CPA or not, you're paying 9 points of warp power just to keep things ticking over. So there's no discount for, say, for holding, but at the same time, there's no overload either. So,
right. Oh, yeah.
You basically have to decide, yeah. Like, are you going to use that CPA 3 as a CPA 3, and is that going to mess up your arming cycle? Or will you underload it as a CPA 2 so that you're firing more consistently over the course of the game?
So, wait a minute. Let me see if I understand. And that is, if you want to fire it as a CPA 3, you have to specify that on the first turn of arming?
No, okay. You have to arm it over 3 turns.
Right.
So, but there's no fast loading either.
Okay. Assuming you have a CPA 3, is that even a question? I guess it really isn't it. I was thinking about whether the CPA 3, if you could actually leave it at CPA 2 level and do a kind of a rolling delay based on CPA 2.
You can't do that, yes.
Oh, okay.
You're not forced to upgrade the warhead. So basically, like, the question would be that if you look at the damage chart for the CPAs,
right?
If you'd have to basically run the numbers on the side, given the amount of firing opportunities you're going to have over 2 turns instead of 3, mm-hmm. and given how much damage each CPA does at level 2 instead of level 3, is it more effective to stick with the CPA 2 for all the weapons? Or so wait the third turn and, you know, add the CPA-3's firepower to it.
Right.
So basically, the Badavai made the decision that, with some exceptions, because most of the war classes that the Badavai use, like the War Cruiser and War Destroyer, they rely on CPA-2s.
Mm-hmm. I think we can find the War Cruiser for habit. I don't think I do. Probably a different book. Yeah.
It's a few pages over. It's like about maybe 10 or 15 pages over, but it's the same SSC book, though.
Mm-hmm. Ah, there it is. Okay. Much farther down.
Yeah.
But I thought it was going to be near the top with the rest of the cruisers, but it's not.
No, because with the exception of the strike cruiser, they mainly go through the middle years cruisers, and then they do the wartime cruisers after.
I did not mean to do that. Okay, there it is. Okay.
Now, you'll notice as well that for the Badavai, all of their heavy weapons are in the forward arc. So they're not like the Amin, because the whole reason why the Indians split their arcs is because they learned the hard way what happens if you try to run into the front of a Badavai ship with its CPAs fully armed.
Right.
So the Badavai, basically, they're more kind of Fed-like in the sense that they want to hit you with the direct fire, like, head-on, or at least somewhere in the front arcs, whereas the Indians are more kind of like the Klingons, where they want to keep you at a distance. Mm-hmm. Although, ironically enough, the Badavai have a better turn mode than the Indians. So, for the Tholians, the obvious thing in terms of the SSD would be to take the photon torpedo variant cruisers and ships and replace the photons with something. Now, the way that the firing arcs are on the Tholian ships is that most of the option mount, the weapon mounts, so to speak, are not adjacent to each other. Like, if you look at a Tholian heavy cruiser, it's got a photon heavy cruiser, rather. It's got one photon on the left side, LF plus L. It's got a separate photon, R plus R, on the other side of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And then the front of each of the two wedges has photons 3 and 4. So it would not be able to use the CPA-3 anyway, which means that by default, the Tholians are going to be using the CPA-2, unless they have maybe some sort of Dreadnought variant or something, or some right. other variant that does have Jason's photon nulls. But even then, you might say, why would the Tholians use that? Would they not be better off having two separate CPAs? Because they've got lots of warp reactors. They've got plenty of warp power. So they don't have to worry as much as the Batavi. Although, if you think about it, if you have the SSD for the Photon Heavy Cruiser, if you replace all four of the photons with CPA-2s, that means that ship is always going to pay 12 warp points of warp power every turn.
Ouch.
So some of that is taken up by the AWRs, but the rest of it is still coming out of the warp engines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so which means overall, it might be a better idea to use the neutron beam from the Anine than the CPA from the Batavi. Because it gives you more flexibility and more maneuverability. Overall.
Mm-hmm. Or what you could do is, because you could use the photon, or the sorry, you could use the CPA variants as base defense units. So the ship isn't going anywhere. It's sitting behind a layer of web. And then if an enemy ship gets through it, like an Andromedan even, surprise, you've got a big, you get four CPA-2 shots on your front PA panel. But for open space battles, it would be better to stick with the neutron beam.
Mm-hmm. Understood. But at the same time, you would think that the Tholians would select one weapon instead of using one weapon from each, two different empires.
Well, in fairness, you could say the same thing in the Alpha Octant, but then ADB decided to give them photon variants. So.
True.
But yes, if they only get one, they should use the neutron beam.
Yeah. Actually,
when you think about it, even if you're defending a base, if your ship is parked behind a layer of web,
right,
then as long as you get the enemy ship on your front center line, then you can hit them with all the neutron beams at once. And that's not a bad amount of damage.
Agreed. And, as I said, I think having a single weapon, for both mobile and stationary ships, but that's not right. Battle platforms. There's a nice generic term. Would be best. Definitely would keep down on maintenance.
Because
you'd be able to use the same parts from ships to the bases. So, what are you gonna say?
There are a couple of local weapons that they might want to watch out for. Oh yeah. So when it comes to the weapons that are shooting at them, there's a few they might want to be careful about. Because when the Magadine show up, their main weapon, the tachyon beam, it actually, when it hits properly, it actually damages both the facing shield and the opposite shield at the same time. So,
right.
That would be a challenge for the Tholians to deal with. But on top of that, how in the Alpha Octant, the drone empires eventually developed the is it the Spearfish drone?
Right.
So there's a similar missile called the CPM that mass drivers can get. The Magadine get them first, but the Vatavai get them later. But what they do is that, because all this time I had thought that what the CPM did is it hits the outer shield for 1 point and then the inner shield for 2 points. But what it actually does is it bypasses the outer shield entirely. It hits the inner shield for 1 point, and it does internals for 2 points.
Oh.
Not against other Magellanic ships. Against Galactic ships, it actually hits the shield for the 1 point and then does 2 points of internals, like a Spearfish gun.
Wow.
And remember that mass drivers don't travel on the board the way drones do. They're quasi-direct fire weapons, so when the enemy ship is firing it at you, you have to deal with it right away. So if the Magadim or Badavai, or even the pirates, who can use mass drivers as well, if they load up, because it's only a certain percentage of your mass driver missiles can be CPMs or any other non-standard missile. But if they front load them and decide to fire them at a Tholian ship, then all those thick shields are not going to help very much. Especially because if you're caught in open space with no webcaster or no webster.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's one question that...
And on top of that...
This.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Well, we can ask is...
Oh, sorry. Go.
Okay, go. Go.
Well, the other thing, too, is there's a species called the Othiki. They eventually become allies of the Badavai, but then the Andromedans exterminate them. They have a weapon called the Boson Drill. And the drill from the Boson Drill, it's like a shield cracker. It damages shields only. But then the bit, because what happens is that when you arm the Boson Drill, it's 2 points of power from any source for the drill. And then the bit element is 1 point of warp power. So against Magellanic shields, what it does is the drill element affects the outer shields, but ignores the volume reduction factor. And the bit element lands on the inner shield facing. But against Galactic shields, the outer shields are affected by the drill, and the bit scores as internals. So if the Othiki are fighting the Tholians, then they're able to reduce the shields and also score internals with that weapon.
Mm-hmm. Which brings up the question I was going to ask, which is, here's the thing, that let's say that the Tholians landed in the LMC. Now, obviously, they have to find a replacement for the particle cannon. Okay, fine. But also, we're talking about a different configuration of shields and the weapons that are designed in that in the LMC are designed for a different configuration of shielding. Now, here is the question, which is, do you think that the Tholians would actually modify the shield configuration to match the LMCs, the empires that were there, so that they were not a deficit defensively compared to other LMC ships?
No, because if you look at the Jindarians, they've been in the LMC for about 100,000 years, the same time they've been in both Alpha and Omega. But the Jindarian ships in the LMC still use a regular shield. So I would, and also because I think you have to build a ship from the keel up to have like the Magellanic systems. Like they're like basically like their shipyards kind of construct their ships by default.
Okay.
To have things like their sensor scanner systems and their shield network, whatever. So the Tholians will have to, they have to completely rework the auto forges, and they don't even know how to do that.
Understood.
Bear in mind that the Tholians press a button and the ship comes out. So it takes a long time for them to train the engineers they need to figure out how to build their ships again. So
right.
I don't think it's worth it. But yeah, bear in mind that I think that they'll get by without it. They get by without it. So because their shields are pretty thick, and despite those weapons I just mentioned, there aren't that many of them. So, the web is a useful thing. So, I think that they'd be functional with just the regular layer of shields. They just have to be careful relative to how they'd be in Alpha or Omega. Also, because which of course would be the whole point of sending them. But But actually, here's an interesting interaction. If the Sultorians reach the LMC, shield crackers ignore the volley reduction factor. So Sultorian ships are proportionally that little bit more effective against the natives.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
But to make up for that, because the particle cannons are so weak, you'd need to use the shield crackers to get the outer shields down, because a lot of the impact from the particle cannons would be lost in the volume reduction factor anyway.
Right. And, you know, well, you know, that doesn't mean anything. I was thinking about, of course, the issue of the inner shields, because, you know, they can't use the shield cracker to bring down the shield so that they can bring Marines on board, which is, you know, I understand that normally, not normally, but the main reason for the shield crackers were to board ships and capture them. But, you know, for the most part, that's not the goal of the Sultorians. Sultorians are want to destroy them, you know, after.
Well, in the LMC, there's two things, because one of them is outer shields, because of the volley reduction factor, they cost twice as much to reinforce. And if I recall correctly, there's no such thing as specific reinforcement. It's only general reinforcement. And also, inner shields can't be reinforced at all. So, once the Sultorians, rather, if they concentrate enough fire to get the outer shield down, then as long as they get access to the inner shield, getting that down isn't that much trickier, because if you look at because the inner shields cover three facings at once, then they're proportionally more vulnerable. Especially because if you think about it, if an LMC ship wants to lower its shield to beam Marines over somewhere, they have to drop the facing outer shield and the facing inner shield. So that means that the two adjacent facings are vulnerable as well.
Right.
So it's not all good news for the way the shield dynamics work. So,
did not know that.
And also, all those phasers that the Sultorians have, that would help them in terms of shooting down mass drivers, or maybe trying to, you know, whittle down the plasma E that the Anine might be using.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That definitely would be an interesting scenario, which is the Sultorians invading, and having the top part of I would think about that is that would there, as I think we pointed out, when it comes to the Omega Octant, one of the reasons why the Sultorians survived was basically because they had a big brother that was helping him out. And the question is there any one with the Tholians basically wipe out the Anean, basically the other empires before the Andromedans show up? And therefore nothing to fight. Or with the would there be the empire within the LMC that actually would be amenable to siding with the Sultorians and helping them to attack the Tholians?
Well, by that point in time, the Andromedans would have mostly completed their conquest of the LMC. So you'd basically see the Sultorians fighting and probably losing against the Andromedans before they got a chance to kill the Tholians. But also, because I suspect that the Tholians could probably end up being, unless they have a way to repair their engines and fly the sphere elsewhere, like if they're stuck in the LMC for say if there's an engine breakdown, they might end up losing the sphere to the Andromedans. So they'd have to use the same asteroid shipyards that the Mazalanics use. So on the one hand, Andromedans will be killed as the Thorians for them. But on the other hand, the Tholians might still be in exile and have to wait for Operation Unity to rescue them from the Andromedans.
That definitely would... That the question, if the Andromedans actually would come that come the same time and therefore would actually capture the Dyson Sphere, would it actually capture it or destroy it? Because if it captured it, my question then would be, could the Tholians then use that to maybe finish the desecrator that they needed to finish, or possibly move it inside the Dyson Sphere for maybe so for more protection?
Well, there are rules in Fed of Empire to show like what happens if the Klingons or anyone else succeeds in taking over the Tholians, like how many economic points they get. Now, the Andromedans probably won't get as many because I suspect that the number of EPs that the Tholians have is basically factoring in those the lost Klingon colonies that
right.
the Tholians occupy control.
Mm-hmm.
So there probably won't be as many EPs that the Tholians would have to spend in the first place, or that the Andromedans can get it once they conquer the sphere.
Right.
But I would suspect that the Andromedans would just treat the sphere as another captured planet, basically. Like, they just extract whatever tribute that they get, and then they would keep the desecrator nice and far away because they wouldn't want it to be near any of their subject planets. So... Mm. But whether or not that would make a difference in terms of how far ahead the Andromedans are in terms of building their cool toys from the module C3A, it's a good question, but
yeah,
what I'm
yeah.
not too sure about.
Yeah, because you're bringing in basically an external resource out from the extragalactic resource into the galaxy, and therefore increasing, in theory, the number of EEPs that it can produce, if you're thinking about it at the strategic level.
Well, the other thing is, like, how many more Andromedans ships are being destroyed to conquer the Tholians? So it could all balance out. It could be that if you include the Tholians and you include any of the Tholian bases with the webs around them, maybe the Andromedans lose a few more ships, other ships, whatever, to take them out. So that any additional resources they get from the sphere as a conquered planet, so to speak, balances out to the same place that you are historically.
Mm-hmm. Understood. Huh. Well, I think...
Now, I should say that I still think that Omega is the most open place to put the Tholians
yes.
in terms of giving them more options, but
oh,
it's just that, ironically, the LMC is a tidier one because it's cleaner in terms of knowing what weapons to give them and, you know, how to do it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think the alternate history where the Tholians land in the Omega, I think it would be more possible, I think. And, you know, because of it's more like the Alpha Octant. And, you know, because it actually has some open space where you actually can have the Tholians kind of grow their wings. And not have to worry about someone beating down their door. You know, the only reason the Klingons didn't spend more time, you know, fighting the Tholians was because they had another, you know, front called the Federation, you know, which, so it did not help. You know, the Klingons really didn't want to spend the resources if they didn't have to, but they felt like they needed to. They couldn't just let the Tholians free range and just expand in that area, which is why they were more than thrilled when the Sartorians came. It's like, oh, we want to attack them. The Tholians, the Klingons then didn't have to waste their own ships on attacking the Tholians. They had to say, the Tholians, go after them. Have fun. So, anyhow, it's getting late. It's time to shut the sucker down. Gary, it's been a pleasure.
Plug.
Yes, Doug.
Thank you. And
I missed something.
I was just going to say, Paul, that if you or Doug or anyone wants to add your thoughts on the BDS, by all means, pop in and talk with your thoughts.
Okay. We'll do. But anyway. Okay. Well, have a good night.
Have a night.
Doug! Always good to have you around.
And hey, plug time.
And of course, the usual plug for the...
Yes, please.
Yeah.
Gamers. Yes, please. Yeah, we got Gamers of Women. Or Gamers of Summer, I should say. Sorry.
Yeah.
Coming up in about 3 weeks now.
Yep.
And we're going to be having a SFP tournament there.
Yes, we will.
For anybody listening in SFP land that likes SFP tournaments, Paul will be running a tournament there. Yay!
Yep. Paul. Yeah, come on by. That. You know, I'll be there. It's Harrisburg. Obviously, look for Gamers of Summer. I think it's gamersofsummer.net. Is that correct, Doug? When it comes to the website?
I believe, yeah. Let's see. Hold on a second here. Yeah, it is gamersofsummer.net. I can actually give you the link here in 1 second. That's it. There we go. That's it. Copy and paste. Oh. There you go.
Okay.
Throw it in chat. GamersofSummer.net and so that'll get you there. But Labor Day weekends, second, third, and fourth. The tournament will be Saturday and Sunday. We have a contingency plan if we have to go to Monday, which is we'll wing it. So as far as I know, that was kind of it. So, there's that. And there is a space when you go to register that says remarks. So if you want to sign up for the SFP tournament ahead of time, you can do that. Yep. Do that there and just say SFB tournament and maybe let Paul know what ship you want to run. So there you go.
Okay.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you. Have a good night. So another possible alternate history with the Tholians, you know, with them in the LMC, which could be interesting. And the question there, of course, there's one question that I did not bring up that I just came to my mind, which is, would it be possible that the Tholians would to take over the LMC, which would be interesting? Don't know. You know, it would be interesting to see how the Tholian ships would turn out and how good they could actually be against the different ships of the LMC, because if it's possible, then they could possibly conquer those empires before the Andromedans show up. Of course, then the Andromedans might just wipe the Tholians, and that would make things even more interesting, because as we already mentioned at the beginning, which is if the Tholians didn't show up, then the Romans would be under the Klingon protectorate and things would be quite a bit different when it comes to how that and the general war and that all turned out. I'm not exactly sure what the effect that would have on the Federation and so forth. And also the Gorns themselves, because if they're not building plasma ships, they're building basically Klingon ships to fight the Gorns. How does that dynamic work? You know? Oh, agreed. Agreed. Sorry. Chat room over there. So with that, I am Paul Fran, and I bid you a good night.